Welcome to the Grow Bold with Disability podcast, brought to you by Feros Care, a podcast dedicated to smashing stereotypes and talking about the things people with disability care about most to help us live bolder, healthier, better connected lives. I'm journalist Pete Timms.
And I'm Tristan Peters. I work for Disability Service Directory Clickability and am a wheelchair user living with spinal muscular atrophy.
Today's episode of Grow Bold with Disability is Growing Bold and Disability within the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community. And our guest is Wachabalak Elder, champion wheelchair basketball player and Australia's very first Indigenous Paralympian, Kevin Combs, OAM. In this episode, we'll discover how Kevin became a paraplegic, what treatment was available for him back in the 50s, and how a rehabilitation program, which included basketball, changed his life forever. And for our regular listeners, you'll notice that Tristram isn't with us today, but he will be joining us again in our next episode. Kevin, welcome to Grow Bold with Disability.
Thanks very much.
Mate, let's start way back in 1953 when you were left a paraplegic after being accidentally shot in the back while out hunting with some cousins. Tell us about that incident.
Yeah, I was 12. My other cousin, he was 14. And two little blokes were tagging along behind us. They were both nine-year-olds. Anyway, we're walking through the floodwaters and of the 1953 floods they had up in New South Wales, where I come from, up Balranald, which is about 60 miles across the border from Swan Hill up north. And we'd go shooting rabbits and hang them up, and the rabbit would come and pick them up the next day. It's one way of making a few dollars, you know. Mm-hmm. And we're walking. We decided to sit down and have a bit of a rest when we come to one of these little islands. And we said, oh, we should go that way, go that way. And I said, no, we'll go this way. And then this little bloke, he was only nine, he come along and started playing with the gun, my gun. And I heard it go click, and I said to myself, I think I left a bullet in that. And he put it at me and pulled the trigger. Sure enough, I did leave a bullet in it, and it hit me in the back. Just it came out between me ribs on me left hand side, just missed me out. I was very lucky to be alive, really.
So what was the immediate reaction? What happened? Did they had to get you to, obviously, the hospital? Did the ambulance come to you? Did they have to carry you back out? What happened?
We were out the bush, something like 30 miles out of town, and my uncle was clearing the land out there, and they were doing a big irrigation thing, and they said, well, you can, if you clear the land, you can keep the wood. So he had a contract with the hospital up there, and he made a lot of money, my uncle, and we're out there helping him as kids, you know, school holidays and stuff like that. Mm. And an old uncle of mine, he threw me in the back of the car, and I kept, after I shot, I was dozing in and out of consciousness, as I said, and there was a lot of gates going to get to the highway. There's something like 12 gates.
Wow.
He didn't bother opening the gates. He just went straight through. He had an old Vauxhall, which the front of the doors used to open from the front. Now, they open backwards.
Oh, yeah, the suicide doors, yeah.
And he used to polish that and polish it every day. And when we pull up to get on the highway, lights rang off it, and the bumper car was all wrecked. And he got me, he ended up rushing me to hospital, and then they didn't know what blood group I was. Sure enough, mm-hmm. I was me uncle's blood group, so they sorted that out and got me to the hospital, and then had that operation, which was about that night. So it'd be, I was shot in the afternoon, and I was then taken from Balranald to Swan Hill and operated on that night.
So what was the diagnosis from the doctors after they did remove the bullet?
Well, they knew I was a paraplegic, but they didn't know too much about paraplegia in those days, because if you had a spinal injury back then, you lived for only about 5 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, and here I am, mate, 60-odd years later.
So what you talk about was pretty, you know, you ended up at Swan Hill. What was the treatment? What treatment was available? Did they do a lot of experiments on you? Because as you say, you know, it was all pretty new back then.
Pretty new. It was really terrible, mate. They'd wash me in the morning and I'd be laying in my own poo and my own urine and stuff like that. And I had 24 stitches in my stomach, and to forget for me to pass urine, the doctor used to do handstands on my stomach.
Oh, what?
Express urine out of me, because they didn't know what catheters and stuff like that were around now. But it was pretty rugged.
I mean, you also, there was other complications too. I did read that you developed bed sores and were forced to spend a year laying on your stomach to recover.
That's right, because when I was, as I said, they'd wash me in the morning and I'd be laying in my own excrement and urine for that day, you know, and that night. And they'd give me a bath in the morning. Anyway, the reason why they sent me down to Melbourne, because that looks as though it was going to be with a bed sore and that, it looks as though it was going to get into my bloodstream and kill me. So that's why they, you know, me blood poisoning and stuff like that. That's why they sent me to Melbourne. I didn't see another black face for 2.5 years, and for a little 12-year-old kid coming from the country who was heavily involved with his family and that, it was pretty hard.
So why didn't you see your family for 2.5 years? Just too hard for them to get down to you and work and so forth, or?
Well, there wasn't a lot of work around those days, and it wasn't. I don't think it was any dull. So my father was a woodcutter plus a drover, so he was away all the time, and it was pretty hard. As I said, jobs weren't hard to come, and there wasn't any Aboriginal organisations back in the early 50s.
Mm.
So nowadays they've got Aboriginal organisations, and those organisations would help if I got hurt today, you know.
Well, the concept of disability is quite foreign for the Aboriginal communities. There's no real sort of word for disability, is there, in the Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander language?
No.
So tell me, how do Indigenous people sort of view disability?
Well, I was very fortunate in 81. I was in the International Year for the Disabled in 1981. The great bloke by the name of Charlie Perkins said, there's a bloke down in Melbourne that can talk a bit. So he wanted me to be on this national committee. So I was on that national committee, and that's what that committee was fighting for, is to be like the Aboriginals. They know that I'm that they knew that I get around in a wheelchair, but I they didn't see me as disabled, because I could work, I could do whatever I want to do. Mm. I used to travel all over Australia by myself when I was working with Aboriginal hostels for about 19 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've seen me as a bloke that gets around the wheelchair, but he's not disabled. Yeah. And that's what that International Year was supposed to be like, is to make to be like the Aboriginal groups that looked at you and seen that you were disabled, in the sense that you got around the wheelchair, but you could do just about anything you wanted to do.
Well, there's one thing that you are pretty damn good at, and that's basketball. So tell us, you introduced to basketball as part of your rehabilitation. What is it? What drew you to basketball?
Well, it's part of the rehab at the Austin Hospital when we were playing out there, and when we were, because there wasn't any place I could go to in Melbourne. I didn't know anyone. There wasn't hostels around in those days. So I was stuck in hospital for so long, and I'd go over there and practice after all our program was finished. And we'd be out there, you know, no shirt on and trying to attract some nurses. And because of our build and stuff like that. And that's how we got into basketball. And then they had the Australian Championships here in Melbourne in 1960. And then they, myself and a bloke by the name of Bruno Moretti, who is still a mate of mine. I still bring him up every now and again, see how he's going. Mm. He's a little bit younger than me, but he was a good ball player. And we were selected in the national team to go to Rome in 1960. I always say that I took him along as my interpreter.
Well, Bruno Moretti would be helpful in Italy, wouldn't he? So that was the very first Paralympic Games, as you say, in Rome, 1960. What was the very first Paralympic Games like?
A lot different to what it is today, of course, because the very very quiet. It was normally after the Olympic Games, and I think it still is.
Yep.
But it's, you know, since the corporates got involved and Channel 7 and those people who got involved in, it's turned into some program now. And, I always say it's a big family, and I'm proud to be part of that family.
Yeah, nice. Now, you were the only Aboriginal person representing Australia at those games. How were you accepted by your team's mates?
Pretty good. They sort of look after me. They one case there was the Zimbabwean people were in this bar at the games. I think it was in 1968 or something like that. Might have been. Yeah. What about 68? Yeah. Because I missed 64 because I discovered women, mate. 64 and I was chasing girls.
Fair enough.
Yeah. But 68 I went to because they didn't have the games in Mexico or whatever because of the high altitude. They decided to have it in Israel.
That's right, Tel Aviv, yeah.
Yeah. And I went there and we're in this bar one night and my mates were having coffee, but I had a beer. And then this Zimbabwean bloke looked at me and said, well, they're keeping the bar open for niggers, are they?
Oh.
And I said, oh, I didn't want to punch on there. No. So I reported him to my team manager, who's a terrific fellow from Sydney. He's passed on now. Kevin Betts, his name was.
Yep.
He was the manager of our team, and he said, point him out tomorrow morning. And this bloke must have had a big knot on the grog because he had bright red the next day. And I said, there he is there. And I pointed, and Kevin Betts went and grabbed him by the front of the shirt, lifted him up on his feet, and he was going to punch him. And but he said, don't ever speak to one of my boys like that ever again. And I said, good on you.
Yeah, wow.
I got to be fair to that Zimbabwean fella. from then on, he was, he couldn't do enough for me, and he was very friendly towards me, and that was fine.
Wow. So after those first games in the 60s, you came back, as you said, in 64. You discovered women as well. I'm sure you discovered them just before that, though. Now, mate, you also went out into the big bad world and had to fend for yourself. So you're a young guy, wheelchair-bound, Aboriginal man looking for work in the 60s. How was that?
Pretty hard.
Yeah.
One of my mates, a big Yugoslav fella, who was in a wheelchair himself, he got me my first job, and I worked with his company, his mate's company for 12 months, and then they moved way out to Springvale, and I thought I can't drive over there back every day because it was just paying for petrol to get there. So I decided to resign from that. So I got people that were looking after us. So they said he can talk a little bit. So I got a job as a sales rep on the phones, you know.
Yep.
I was selling stuff like printer's inks and anything to do with printing.
Yep.
I was the man to take because we could sell you a machine or we can sell you anything to do with printing. And I did that for 15 years.
Oh, yeah?
But all up, I was in the workforce for 25 years. No, 39 years, actually.
Wow.
I was in the government for 25 years of that 39 years. The rest was at the Collies Inks where I worked for many years. And my mates, I'm still mates. There's four or five blokes that we have lunch couple of times a year.
Yeah, and, nice.
And it's great to be part of that too.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you say, you had a very long working career, but you never actually left basketball. Like, you came in and out. You went, as we were just talking about, the 68 Paralympics in Israel, in Tel Aviv. Yes. What was it about basketball that kept drawing you back to want to play?
Yeah, well, as I said, I wanted to travel and see the world, and that's one of the ways I did. I went to America a couple of times, play over there. I went to England a couple of times, play over there. All up, I've been to America a couple of times and also to Europe and England and Germany. I tell you what, there's nothing better than sitting on a boat traveling down the Rhine and sipping a nice white wine.
Nice Riesling, a nice Rhine Riesling. Yeah. You've got that right. Yeah. Now, amongst some of your amazing achievements, you captained the basketball team in the 72 Paralympics, and then you captained the Australian team in the 74 Commonwealth Games. There's regional, domestic, all that championships. You retired in after your fifth Paralympics in 84.
Yes.
What's your favourite memory looking back? What's your greatest achievement, do you think?
Well, I suppose one of the things that came my way was I got the Order of Australia back in 81 because of my contribution to disabled sport and to Aboriginal welfare in Victoria. Because I worked for, as I said, I worked for Human Services and Health for down here for 25 years of that 39 years, you know. So it was a great career. It opened with basketball. It opened a lot of doors for me and become well known. And like Andrew Gaze, for instance, he played in five Olympics. I played in five Paralympics.
Yeah.
So I had a great career, and it was just a marvellous thing to be part of Basketball Australia, and I still am. I go to their I'm a Hall of Famer. Yep. That was back in when John Howard was the Prime Minister, and I went up to – I was going through a really bad time with health, and I wanted my my youngest girls to go up to get my award, you know, the Basketball Hall of Fame. And she said, "Dad, I want you to go because you're the person that deserves this, not me." But anyway, she said, "You can do it." So I ended up doing it, and I was very glad that she made me do it because it was a great night, and I was inducted with a few other people. Rachel Sporn, you might remember her. Mm. She played for Australia.
Yep.
She was inducted on the same night, mm-hmm. and a few other people. But it's been a great career, mate, to be part of the Paralympic family.
Yeah, you would have seen a lot of changes over the time too, because as you said, you were an advocate all the way back in the 60s, helping found the Paravic Sports Club. They even named part of it after you now. What's been some of the biggest changes you've seen with disability and sport being accepted now compared to what it was back then?
It's a big difference nowadays. With I can recall that we used to go out and shake tins outside the VFL games, you know, outside the gates. And it helped the boys to go to Rome, and helped the boys to go to here, and helped the boys to go here. But we'd have to go begging, really.
Yeah.
Not the case anymore, because a lot of these people that are around nowadays, they just turn up for training, and that's it. Everything's paid for. which is all about progression, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all about progression, and it's very pleasing to see that when the corporates got involved and Channel 7, they got involved in showing the Paralympics. I was never so proud in all my life when I was involved in the organising committee in 2000 for SOCOG and the Paralympics. In Sydney, because I was up there every couple of weeks, to see in the first game we played, I think we played Britain, wheelchair basketball, and there was something like 22,000 people at the game.
Wow!
Oh yeah, just unbelievable. Yeah.
Fantastic.
And I was sitting in the box. Because I carried the torch down here in Melbourne, carried the torch inside the stadium. I was one of the six athletes that carried the bar inside the stadium. There was 100,000 people in Sydney that night, and I named a street after me up there.
Yep,
it's still there. Because I was talking a couple of weeks before they went to Rio. They invited me up, and I went up, and Kevin Knight, who was the Olympic minister at the time, he said, "I'm here for 2 weeks, Kevin. Just have a look around your street." He said, "If you want anything done to it, you better do it now, because I'll be out of here in 2 weeks' time." I said, "Right, mate." But it was a great thing, that, because if I can just tell you this little story about... Because the minister rang me from, he said, "Can you come up on Tuesday?" I said, yeah. So I went up. He said, "We'll have someone pick you up at the airport and take you to the Parliament House." So I did that, and then I get into this room. There's Shane Gould, Murray Rose, the great Murray Rose.
Yep.
He passed on, of course, and Dawn Fraser and... Herb Elliott and a few others that were there, and all their names are named streets after them too. Marjorie Jackson was another one, who ended up being the governor of South Australia, and a terrific person. And I thought, I'll just I'll watch Dawn, because I know Dawn. I'll follow what she says. But then they were doing it in alphabetical order, wasn't they? So a C comes before
the F.
Yeah. So I was first cab off the rank. Oh. If you can imagine, all the TV networks were there.
Yeah.
And you got all these cameras, and the cameras going off in your face, and people asking you questions, and you're trying to talk sense, you know.
Yep, sounds smart.
It was very overwhelming, really, but it was the first thing that. But I sort of look back and have a bit of a chuckle because I've seen Dawn since, and I always say that it was a wonderful night, or that day when they named streets after us up in Sydney.
Yeah, amazing. What do you think of this new generation of well, they've been around a little bit now, the new generation of the Paralympians and the sporting heroes like your Kurt Fearnleys or your Dylan Allcotts? They're doing amazing things for disability in sport.
They are, yeah, and I've got the utmost respect for Kurt because I've seen what he did. I remember seeing him when as a 10-year-old, and I thought to myself, you know, when they had junior championships, and I'd rock up, and if I was able to, I'd rock up and have a look at it, see what new talent was coming, and I thought to myself, this bloke's going to be a superstar, and it turned out I was right.
Now, mate, we're almost there. Our podcast, as you probably know, is called Grow Bold with Disability. Now, we always ask one last question to our guests, and that is, what does growing bold mean to you?
Growing bold?
Mm.
Oh, no, I've always been very confident in what I do. I've always been pretty bold and not backward and coming forward. And I've got something to say, I will. If I see something that's out of place or some people doing the wrong thing, I'd tell them. So I suppose that's being bold. But I don't want to be intrusive for anyone, but I think people should respect other people, and not all people are the same.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, nice. Now, Kev, thanks so much for joining us here today on Grow Bold with Disability podcast. It's brought to you by Feros Care, and our listeners can find out more about Kevin in the links provided in today's episode show notes. Mate, that was a fantastic talk. Thank you so much for joining us today here on Grow Bold with Disability.
You're welcome, mate, and thanks for thinking of me, and good luck to you for your program.
This podcast is brought to you by Feros Care, an NDIS partner delivering local area coordination services in Queensland, South Australia, and the Australian Capital Territory. Feros Care is a people care organisation committed to helping people live bolder lives. We call it Growing Bold, and for over 30 years, Feros has been making it real for both older Australians and those living with disability. To find out more, head to feroscare.com.au.